From Foreign Policy, I'm Sarah Wildman, and this is First Person. This week, why it's increasingly difficult to find asylum in the United States. In mid-July, the Trump administration announced that it planned to fast-track deportations for undocumented immigrants. Going forward, any such immigrants who couldn't prove they had been in the United States for 2 years continuously would be eligible for immediate deportation. The new rule would hit asylum seekers the hardest.
I don't call them raids. We're removing people that have come in, all of these people over the years that have come in illegally. We are removing them and bringing them back to their country.
And there have been other hurdles put in front of asylum seekers.
This rule will bar from eligibility to seek asylum anyone crossing the southern border who came through another country and didn't seek asylum in that country. So as a practical...
The United States has never had such a law, and many of the countries that asylum seekers pass through aren't safe. The changes to the immigration policy were immediately challenged by advocacy organizations like the American Civil Liberties Union. Though these two rules are new, the entire Trump administration has been marked by attempts to limit immigration, both legal and illegal. It began with a so-called Muslim ban, which tried to cut off travel from several Muslim-majority nations, and a delay on refugee acceptance into the country. Both of these rules were fought in the courts.
Justices are now allowing the Trump administration to put a ban on most refugees. The Supreme Court allowing the Trump administration to maintain its restrictive policy on refugees.
Right in the middle of the debate has been HIAS, previously known as the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. HIAS is a 138-year-old organization whose mission began by helping Jews fleeing pogroms and other violence. These days, it seeks to help all refugees. Resettlement organizations for refugees such as HIAS have been hit hard by Trump rules. Our guest this week is Melanie Nezzer, the Senior Vice President for Public Affairs at HIAS. Melanie, thanks for joining us.
Sure, anytime.
So I actually want to start with asking you, what is HIAS?
HIAS is the American Jewish Community's international refugee organization. So we started back in the 1880s, meeting Jewish refugees that were coming to Ellis Island on the boats from Europe. And basically, we'd go down to the docks and bring them kosher meals and connect them with their family members and help them find jobs and just get on their feet. We helped Jews get to safety, so wherever that would be, whether it was to the United States or to another country. And that was pretty much our work throughout the waves of Jewish migration and flight from persecution from our founding in the 1880s until the end of the 20th century. The last great wave of Jewish migration was from the former Soviet Union.
But so from 1924 through the end of the Holocaust, obviously Jewish migration hit a lot of roadblocks. What was the U.S. response to refugees during the war?
Well, interestingly, the response to refugees during the war, we're seeing kind of echoes of that now. Most Americans actually did not favor admitting refugees during and after the Holocaust. And there's a fascinating exhibit at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum called Americans in the Holocaust that actually chronicles American reactions to refugees during that time. But you're right, doors were pretty much shut. Visas went unused for Jews from Germany, and that didn't really change until the 1960s.
Can you explain the difference between a refugee and an asylum seeker?
Absolutely. So it's a little bit different in the United States, the way other countries use it. Both refugees and asylum seekers have to prove the same thing. They have to prove that they fled persecution or have a well-founded fear of persecution based on their race, religion, nationality, membership in a social group, or political opinion. Under the U.S. system, the people that we call refugees are people who come in through the U.S. refugee program, are people who are identified abroad by the State Department, usually in consultation with the UN Refugee Agency, screened abroad and brought here through a system called the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program. An asylum seeker is somebody who shows up at the border and says, I fear I will be persecuted, and is under our law entitled to a hearing to determine whether that person meets the refugee definition or not.
After the war, the beginning of the 1950s, the international community reconsidered refugees, and there was a refugee convention. How did that shift? How did the Holocaust affect the way the world saw refugees?
Well, after World War II, there was a clear global response that there was a horror at what happened to the millions of people who were unable to flee or who were sent back to countries where they could have found safety. So the international community came up with the UN Refugee Convention, which was a way for the global community to say never again would countries turn people back to places where they would be persecuted or killed. And that legal framework has been in place since World War II, since 1951. And in the past 70 years, the U.S. has really been a global leader on refugee protection until now.
And family unification, or keeping families together, that was a plank of that, wasn't it?
Absolutely. There was a huge degree of family separation during and after the war. Many families were separated because they were not resettled or accepted together. And a cornerstone of the refugee protection is keeping families together.
Do you think one of the turning points was the Vietnam War for HIAS?
Well, I mean, during the Vietnam War, that was when the United States really determined that there needed to be a U.S. implementation of the UN Refugee Convention, because until then, we didn't have an asylum law. We didn't have a refugee program. So it wasn't really until 1980 when the U.S. passed the Refugee Act of 1980, which was a strongly bipartisan bill, where we actually had incorporated into our own domestic laws this right to seek asylum and this definition of what an asylum seeker and a refugee is.
And that was passed under Ronald Reagan?
It was signed by Jimmy Carter. But Ronald Reagan, during his presidency, accepted more refugees than any other president, because that was the time, again, when many refugees were fleeing communism and persecution.
So I actually want to turn now to the present, or at least the last 2.5 years. How has the Trump administration changed the work of HIAS?
Well, that's kind of a hard question to answer because the pace of change is so fast that it's very difficult for organizations like ours to respond. Just to give you an example of that, there are fewer refugees now and asylum seekers at our southern border that are coming in because of new policies designed to keep asylum seekers out. But that doesn't mean there aren't thousands of people in need. They're just on the other side of the border. So we are all scrambling to figure out how do we make sure the asylum seekers in Mexico have a safe place to stay, you know, will be protected, have access to information about what their rights are, you know, find their families, are reunited with their families, get information to their families in the U.S., all of these things that every day there are new things that we have to do to respond as the policies shift the populations to other places and create new need. It also puts us in a different position in relationship to our government. We are one of the 9 refugee resettlement agencies. So it's the U.S. government that decides how many refugees. It's the president that decides how many refugees can come in every year. And the U.S. government that decides which refugees to come. And they do all the security vetting and health screening and all the interviews abroad. But once they get here, it's agencies like ours that meet the refugees at the airport, that bring them to their new homes, that stock their fridge with the foods that they need. So, you know, we've always been a partner in that. This has been a longstanding public-private partnership for 40 years where government and nonprofit agencies work together to welcome refugees. And all of a sudden, we find ourselves not on the same page. The president actually set the refugee admissions number this year for 30,000, which is the lowest that it's ever been, and has excluded all kinds of refugees from coming to the United States. So that's very different for us.
What were the numbers in the last years of the Obama administration?
Well, I mean, the historic average over the last few years has been around 70,000, but the last 2 years of the Obama administration, those numbers had been going up. To give you an example, a lot of the reason that the numbers were going up was because of the huge needs of people fleeing Syria. So about, I think it was 2016, we had admitted about 15,000 refugees from Syria, and that was the largest number that we had admitted. And then in the first year that overlapped the Trump administration, that number was 3,000, and then in the past year, that number was 62. So it's a huge decrease in the number of refugees that we're admitting. But overall, the numbers were about 70,000 a year. The last 2 years of the Obama administration were 85,000 was the cap, and then the last year was to be 110,000, but the election happened in between.
We're also at a moment where there are historic highs of refugees sitting in camps and displaced internally around the world since the Second World War.
You're right. There are record levels of displacement right now, more than at any time, including during and after World War II. This is the highest number of refugees and displaced people in recorded history. And historically, the U.S. has been the largest refugee resettlement country. We are no longer the largest refugee resettlement country. We're admitting fewer refugees now than we ever have.
What does that do to the system?
Well, what it does is, first of all, other countries are much smaller than we are. Even though some countries are increasing their numbers, they can't make up for the numbers of people that we are no longer admitting. And just to be clear, these are refugees, many of whom have family members in the United States already, who are worried about them and want to be reunited with them and now no longer can. But the biggest pressure is on the countries, and 85% of refugees are in neighboring countries, in countries that are considered lower income or poor countries that really don't have the resources to care for them, to provide school, to provide job opportunities, to provide the basic things that people need.
From the beginning of the Trump administration, the president and those around him have tweaked at some of the rules. For example, at the beginning, there was the proposed refugee ban. But recently, the administration changed the rules around asylum. Can you explain to me what was the rule and what are they trying to do?
The laws haven't changed. To be clear, Congress hasn't changed the laws, but the way that the administration has decided to implement those laws has changed. For instance, increasing the use of detention of asylum seekers, which the United Nations says should only be used in extraordinary cases. Now it's done as a matter of course. Family separation. You know, we all remember last summer when children were literally ripped from their parents' arms as a way to deter people from seeking safety. When you think about that and what that means, the impact on these kids is going to be lifelong. And the impact on us, I think, knowing that our country was involved in that, is going to probably be pretty long lasting as well. Then there was a policy called metering. So people who applied for asylum, who came to a port of entry, which is a legal entry point along the border, and said, look, I'm fleeing persecution from El Salvador or Honduras or Guatemala or any country where persecution and violence is known to be widespread, endemic. They were told, sorry, you know, you can take a number, which actually does not comport with our obligations under international and U.S. law. Then, when that didn't stop, because remember, people are fleeing persecution. When you flee persecution, you don't sit around. You wait and you take your chances. Then the Remain in Mexico program, the Migration Protection Protocols, I think is the name of that. So that's a policy that says you can apply in the United States, but you have to wait for your case. And these cases can take many years in Mexico.
And where are you supposed to wait?
Wherever you can. So people are waiting in the streets. People are waiting in shelters. People are homeless.
And how is that putting pressure on the border towns?
It's putting enormous pressure on these towns. And again, going back to what I said before, the nonprofit agencies that our mission is to help them are now scrambling to figure out how do we provide assistance to these people on the Mexican side of the border. Because when they wait in the United States, their families take care of them. Their friends take care of them. There's work.
They have access to legal representation.
Absolutely. You know, not everybody, but it's much more accessible. This way, we're trying to figure out, well, how do we make sure that they know what the process is? How do we tell them what documents that they need? All of these things that we're trying to fill these new gaps that didn't even exist. So then there was that. Then there was a new policy that was announced where if you pass through another country, you're expected to apply for asylum there, or you cannot apply for asylum in the U.S. Now, under our law, if you are firmly resettled in another country, if another country has offered you a permanent status, that may be a bar to asylum. But never in our history have we required people to stop and apply in a country where they don't feel safe or don't, you know, many of these countries don't even have functioning asylum systems. So now we're telling people, well, if you pass through another country, you can't apply here, which is not in compliance with our law. So then the administration announced a new policy, which is to expand an expedited removal process, which exists at the border. It's existed there since the 1990s, that basically streamlines processes. So you can theoretically claim asylum, but there's no access to an asylum officer or a judge. So you're trusting Border Patrol to make a decision about whether someone says, I need asylum. And if they don't make that decision, anywhere in the country, for anyone who's been in the country for less than 2 years, they're on a fast track back to the border with no opportunity to seek asylum. So this is also something that's just come out, and we're trying to figure out the ramifications of that, but those could also be pretty severe.
And what is this doing to the American psyche in the way that the refugee or asylum seeker is perceived in American society?
Well, I think immigrants and refugees are being demonized and blamed, and that's a political strategy. And I think it's pretty scary stuff. I know for many people in the Jewish community and other faith communities have taken this really personally. There's been a lot of activism around this because I'm not a refugee myself. I'm not an immigrant myself, but my grandparents were. They were fleeing some of these same things that people are fleeing today. And, you know, many immigrants and refugees in the past have faced this kind of xenophobia and this frenzy around a problem that is actually something that we can manage. There's a decision that the government can make. You can call it a crisis and create a frenzy and whip up anger around it. Or you can say, look, this is an issue at our border. Let's figure out practical ways to solve it. our administration is doing the former and not the latter.
Let's go back and unpack a little bit of what you just talked about. So the fast track, this new rule that's been proposed, what does that mean for those who try to serve as legal representation for an asylum seeker? How do you work?
I mean, all of these things taken together have made it very difficult to represent asylum seekers. And then the other piece of this is the delays. There's not enough resources in our immigration courts and in our asylum system, so these cases drag on for years and years, which doesn't serve anybody's interests, right? For the government's interest, it's better to process these cases quickly so people can get a decision and then be returned. But instead, they're staying 2, 3, 4, 5 years or longer. Legal representation becomes very difficult. People need to move.
Can they work?
They can work after their case has been pending for 6 months.
Have you been to the border?
I have, actually. I was there about a month ago.
And where did you go?
I went to San Diego and I went to Tijuana.
And what did you see?
Well, this was, again, before the most recent shift in policy when there were thousands of people seeking shelter on the U.S. side. So I went to visit the Jewish Family Service of San Diego, actually runs a shelter in San Diego, where basically Good Samaritans will monitor the bus stop in town and say, ICE has just dropped off a couple hundred people. There's no cooperation now. It used to be that we would get some notice, and now there's no notice. So Jewish Family Service will make sure that they can get to the shelter. I saw babies. I saw infants. It's a 1 or 2 days where people get shoes, they get clothes, they get some information about how to get to join their family members and friends. They get bus money and coordination on how to get that bus to get to where they need to go. And then hopefully when they get there, they can find assistance and legal representation. On the other side of the border, we saw shelters that were struggling to provide to families. We went to a women and children's shelter, and we went to a men's shelter. Really people that are doing, and I don't say this lightly, they're really doing God's work to ease people's journeys and to make them as comfortable as they can as they're making some really major decisions about what to do with their future and how they're going to protect their children. And this was before some of these most recent policies where now there are even more people seeking shelter and assistance. So I can't even imagine how crowded and stretched those places are right now.
Where are people from, for the most part?
All over, mostly from El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala. There are some people that have come up through South America. There are really migrants from all over the world. There's no chance now at the refugee admissions program, since that program has been so limited. And, you know, after you've been a refugee for, you know, 4 years, 5 years, 6 years, 8 years, at some point, people just decide to take matters into their own hands because there's no future where they are. They're either in a camp, that's about 20%. The rest are in cities trying to make their way. They may not have work permits. They face discrimination. They may not have housing. And I think back about the decisions that my relatives made. At some point, you're not going to sit there and wait for someone else to make that decision for you because life goes on. There are many refugees from all over the world that are trying to get to the U.S. border to seek safety and to make present an asylum claim. Now, if we had a more global approach to refugees where all of the countries took responsibility, including ours, for providing for them in the countries that they first fled to, providing more assistance, this is something that we do, but not enough. That's part of the solution. But the other part is to make sure that people who cannot remain safely where they are can be resettled in a country where they can be safe. And this is a role that the U.S. has historically played, and we're just not doing that anymore.
Does that mean that HIAS's work, because a huge part of your work was resettlement, has it shifted then since the numbers of those to be resettled has changed?
Right. Well, we are trying to fulfill a need, and we're trying to fulfill our mission. So when fewer refugees were coming to the United States, it's not that there were fewer refugees in the world. As we know, there are more refugees in the world. So we have increased our services to refugees in Latin America. We work with Colombians and Venezuelans and refugees from the Northern Triangle who have fled south. They're fleeing in all directions. So they're in Panama, and they're Costa Rica, and there are other places. And as you know, the Venezuelan crisis is the largest refugee crisis right now in the world. So we're expanding our services in those areas and also really focusing on asylum and the border, because that's really where there's a huge need. People are seeking asylum and many of them have claims, but it's very hard to assert them without an attorney. And it's very hard to assert them if you don't have the support of people around you who can help you integrate into your new country. So we try to provide those services for people.
And does that mean highest attorneys go into the detention centers or the areas that they're sitting in and waiting?
Our model is a little bit different. So we have sent attorneys to existing organizations to increase their capacities. We are also about to open up in Mexico, where we can provide some legal services in Juarez and hopefully in some other communities to coordinate the cases that are in Mexico, but who are trying, people who are trying to make claims in the United States, so that the attorneys in the U.S. have a liaison that can work with the client who's now in Mexico and can't come in. That's a much more complicated and costly way to provide services, but that's the need.
Can you explain to us what the wait is like now for someone who wants to have an asylum case seen before a judge?
The wait is at least several years. It can be longer. And the waits vary depending on where you are in the country. I think it's really important to note that with this Remain in Mexico protocol, not only are the waits really long, so people have to wait in Mexico while their cases are being processed, there have been reports of people who have had appointment letters to come back over the border for their hearing and have been denied entry. So even your ability to get in front of a judge now has become very difficult. But these waits can last for years.
Have you seen the detention centers at the border, of which have been extremely controversial of late? Have you been to any of those?
Yeah, I was at one of the large ICE detention facilities, which is a more permanent structure. It's the Otay Mesa detention facility in San Diego, and they actually share that with the federal marshals. It's a prison. Most people who are there are purely asylum seekers. They've committed no crimes, but if you've ever been in a jail or ever seen one on TV, that's what it looks like. I was not at...
When you say that's what it looks like, describe it a little bit further. Are they wearing jumpsuits? Are they in cells?
People are in jumpsuits. They're in cells. The cells might be a little bit more open, you know, with one door and then rooms inside. But it's very institutional and it's completely secure. There are other facilities along the border that were much more temporary, that were built to be temporary, but housing people for long periods of time. I did not see those myself, but some of my colleagues did, and they're, you know, were very much scarred by what they saw. People really crowded in to like pen-like areas and no freedom of movement and for long periods of time.
How is the opening of that sort of detention center different from what the U.S. has done in the past?
So we have had immigration detention facilities for a long time. I actually started my career about 30 years ago, and I used to represent asylum seekers and other immigrants that were detained at the Chrome Detention Center in Miami, Florida. So we've had detention facilities for a long time. The policy was never to detain everybody, which is the big change. There's really not a lot of consideration about people's family ties, people who can show that they're no threat to the community, people who have children on the outside, people who have children who are in another facility, all of those things. It used to be much more routine to consider those and release people. But it seems like the strategy of this administration is to just deter people from seeking asylum, using detention as deterrence, using pain and family separation as deterrence. And I can't stress it enough. People have a legal right to seek asylum. They don't have a right to asylum. They have to show that they actually meet the refugee definition, but they do have a legal right to seek asylum. And that's what's being violated here by this whole panoply of new policies that seem just really intended to make people's lives miserable enough that they won't do that.
Last year, when there was a shooting in Pittsburgh that took the lives of 11 people at a synagogue, one of his motivating, instigating factors was the work of HIAS and HIAS itself. How did that have an impact on the organization?
I think it still has an impact on the organization. It's been about 8 months. And, you know, You know, first, as a Jewish organization, and many of us are Jewish ourselves, thinking about the tragedy that happened, you know, an attack on a U.S. synagogue, largest attack on Jews in this country's history. You know, we work with Jewish Family and Children's Services of Pittsburgh very closely. They're a refugee resettlement agency that partners with us. So many of our colleagues there knew some of the victims. So that was very personal. And then to think about the fact that we were targeted and why. We're a Jewish organization. We're an American organization. We stand up for the values of welcoming the stranger and protecting the refugee. We don't discriminate based on where you come from, what your religion is. So it just seemed that these were the things that have really been demonized in our country, and that made us a motivation for a really hateful and heinous act. So in the immediate aftermath, we quickly made the decision that we were not going to be deterred. You know, we are continuing to do our work. We have a lot more security than we used to, which is a shame, but it's how it has to be. But we're going to continue, and we do this work all over the world. As long as there's a need, and as long as, you know, what we think are our core American values are under attack, we all need to stand up against that and continue to do our work that's in alignment with what we believe our traditional values are. So we've only grown since then. We're doing a lot more work, particularly overseas and at the border, and we'll continue to do that and to stand up in support of the law and in support of our values.
If this administration is voted out in the next election, what's the impact on the refugee resettlement program? Has it been changed irrevocably, or will it go back to what it was?
You know, we're kind of at a moment where we may be at the point of no return. I don't think we're there yet, but we may be getting there, particularly with the refugee resettlement program. If, in fact, no refugees are allowed into the country next year, the refugee resettlement program is a public-private partnership, and it relies on the work of what's now 200 agencies of different faiths. Some are non-sectarian, in communities in every state around the country that works with refugees to do integration. If no refugees come in, that network will dissolve. And it's taken 40 years to build up the expertise and the relationships with the states and with the local governments and with local businesses and with landlords and with employers. And that will be lost. And so we're not quite there yet, but we could be there soon. And in terms of asylum, people are really getting hurt. People are getting sick. People are dying because of the policies that are being put in place. And it's unnecessary. We are still one of the wealthiest countries on earth. You might say we're the most powerful country on earth. And we've got people at our borders with the clothes on their back that are asking for our help. We can offer to those people a legal system that's fair. We can offer them an opportunity for employment. There are certainly jobs here. We can offer them places to stay, whether it's there with family and friends or with churches or synagogues or others. We have a vast amount of resources and a vast number of people who want to help, but yet we're turning them away.
Thank you, Melanie.
Thanks, Sarah.
That was Melanie Nezer, Senior Vice President for Public Affairs at HIAS. First Person is produced by me, Sarah Wildman, along with Benjamin Soloway and Maya Gandhi. Our editor is Rob Sachs. Our executive editor for news and podcasts is Dan Efron. If you like this episode, subscribe. Find us on iTunes or wherever you find your podcasts. We'll be back next week.